Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on Sunday, June 29th, 2014, on the Premier Networks. This is episode 1096. Enjoy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. And it's time once again to focus on technology, computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, all that jazz, smartphones, of course. 8888-ASK-LEO, that is the phone number, 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada, outside there. You can just call with Skype, and it's a toll-free call, won't cost you anything. You can also visit our webpage, techguylabs.com, techguylabs.com. And say hello to Heather Hammond, the phone ranger, and we'll answer any call. Somebody says, maybe the IRS will call, and we can help them find their lost emails. Could be. I'm a little interested in what's going to happen July 1st, a couple of days from now. Canada's anti-spam law, CASL, comes into effect, and it's really, it's a strong law. We'll see, though. I'm a little concerned. If you send an unsolicited email and you don't have explicit consent from the recipient, you know, just visiting. So if I visit a site and I don't know, you know, this is will play out. If I leave a box checked, for instance, that says, yeah, I'm willing to receive marketing email, does that count as explicit permission? If you don't, your business could be fined up to $10 million. It's Canadian money. It's not. Don't worry. Your CEO and each officer could be fined up to $1 million each. Your marketing agency could be fined $10 million. You got to think companies like Constant Contact and MailChimp are going, hung, 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 hung. You as an individual could be fined up to $10,000. Canada's anti-spam law. What's interesting is Microsoft has responded by saying, as of July 1st, due to changing governmental policies, Microsoft is suspending the use of email notifications for security alerts. Security bulletin advance notices, security bulletin summaries, new security advisories and bulletins, major and minor revisions to security advisories and bulletins, all will be suspended. Not just to Canada, but to everybody. I guess you can't guarantee, you know, if you're sending it to me that I'm in Canada or not. So just boom, that's it. They're gone. They say, just subscribe to our RSS feeds. If you could, I thought that was dead. If you could figure that out. Microsoft's TechNet has the details. I wonder, maybe the law's gone too far. Is it maybe just a little too draconian? It's going to scare some people off. Although, who wants spam, right? I was a little shocked by this. A study that even Facebook's own scientists thought was a little creepy. Did you know that Facebook did this? They modified the news feeds, manipulated the news feeds for a significant number of users to see if their moods would be changed by the kind of stuff in their news feed. Experimental evidence of massive scale emotional contagion through social networks, reads the paper. Submitted from the core data science team at Facebook, the Center for Tobacco Control Research and Education at University of California, San Francisco, and the Department of Communication and Information Science at Cornell University. Did you know that Facebook was manipulating what you saw? Probably legal because Facebook is a private entity, and their excuse was, yeah, we thought it was creepy, but hey, we do this all the time. So 700,000 Facebook users saw something different starting January in 2012 for 1 week. So it's been a while. Don't look at your Facebook feed and go, I'm so sad. Because this was back in January 2012, and only for a week. Some people were shown content with a preponderance of happy, positive words. Some were shown content that was analyzed as sadder than average. And when the week was over, they looked at what you, as a manipulated user, posted and to see if you posted predominantly positive or negative words yourselves. This is a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Since when you use Facebook Sign or agree to terms of service that allow you to relinquish your data for analysis, testing, and research, you've given them permission to do this. The Atlantic asked a Facebook, first they asked the researchers who said, we can't talk to you. You have to go to the Facebook marketing department. This morning, the Facebook marketing department told The Atlantic, we carefully consider what research we do, and we have a strong internal review process. This is completely missing the point, by the way. There is no unnecessary collection of people's data in connection with these research initiatives, and all data is stored securely. That's not what the question was. Is it ethical for Facebook to manipulate your feed to see if you are happy or makes you happier or sadder? Even Facebook's own people thought, yeah, this is kind of creepsy. Normally, this kind of research requires the consent of the, researchee. You're going to be participating in a study with your consent. We won't tell you what the study is, because that would change the results. But normally, they ask you. The referee who reviewed the study, a professor of psychology at Princeton, said she was concerned until she asked the authors, and they said, hey, our local institutional review board, Facebook, approved it. We manipulate news feeds all the time. I understand why people have concerns, but really their beef is with Facebook, not the research. What do you think? If you use Facebook, it's become pretty clear that whatever's in that news feed has no relationship to who you're following. What do I want to see on Facebook? What do you want to see? You want to see pictures from your family and your friends? Do you want to see links to stories from other news sources, viral content? I don't know. Do you? I want to know what family and friends are up to. But Facebook last year decided, no. People go to Facebook because they want to see the latest news. Seems to me pretty darn creepy and a good reason not to use Facebook. What do you think? 8888 Ask Leo. Doesn't it bother you that you might have in January of 2012 seen content with an eye to see if they could make you happy or sad? Isn't that irresponsible of them to try to make people sad? Isn't that wrong? Some people say, hey, Facebook's always been creepy. Get over it. doesn't make me want to use Facebook more, does it? Make you want to use it more? Do you like being a lab rat? It's one thing to say, oh, we're going to tune our feed to give you more news. It just makes Facebook either less or more useful. You'll use it less or more as a result. I use it much less. I find it just not as useful at all. In fact, I'd have long ago quit Facebook if I didn't feel like I have to use it so I can answer your questions about it. It's just not, I don't find it that interesting. But now I'm like, what? And every time I go there, I'm thinking, are they trying to make me happy? Are they trying to make me sad? Garbage. Just a garbage site. And I'm glad to know that when you read a lot of happy stuff, it could make you happy. When you read a lot of sad stuff, it could make you sad. Really? You needed to do a study to find that out? That was important. We talked about it yesterday, but of course the Supreme Court on Friday ruled that Aereo was a copyright violator, and Aereo has decided to suspend its business. I think a lot of people upset about it. I'd like to know what you think. And I'm not going to tell you what I think just yet. I'll leave you in suspense. See, I'm manipulating you. 8888 Ask Leo. Your call's next. From Boy George to Girl Heather. Hello, Heather Hummond, the Phone Ranger.
Hello.
Hello.
Do you use the Facebook?
Yes. What is it about?
Don't you hate yourself every time you go there?
I do. Thank you. I hate it.
I hate myself, too. I look at it and I go, why am I doing this?
I take a peek in when I'm waiting for a coffee to come up at a shop, and I'm like, oh, my God, really?
It's a time waster.
Adult men that I know from high school or whatever,
yeah,
crying like little girls. I'm like, what?
Yeah. Well, that's because Facebook made them sad.
Exactly. I guess so. Just horrible, pathetic posts.
I deeply wish I could give this up. You know what I did give up this week? I'm very proud of it. I gave up the Simpsons Tapped Out game.
Uh-oh.
This is a game. It's like Farmville, Wii Rule. It's a game, but it's, you know, I liked it because it had the Simpsons characters. There was a little humor in it. And I'd been doing it for a long time. And in fact, about 8 months ago, it crashed on me, and I was so happy. And then Electronic Arts, 8 months later, fixed it, and I got back on it. And I realized, I was talking to Lisa, both of us realized we spend more than an hour a day farming.
Lisa and I were going to have you taken away to SA. Simpsons Anonymous.
Simpsons Anonymous. She's as bad as I am. So we both made a pact. We made a mutual pact. We deleted it. But before I deleted it, they just recently added a nuclear button where you could blow up the whole thing, and it's blank. And then I wrote bye-bye in trees. Because this is how they get you, these social things. Farmville's the same way. Your friends get mad at you if you quit. Because, they're visiting you and you're visiting them, and there's a social component. And there's this huge peer pressure not to quit these games.
So it really is like alcohol or gambling.
It's work. I think it's similar because I do think it changes your brain chemistry. There's something soothing about tapping Lisa and Bart and Homer. And
dopamine squirt.
But I was thinking an hour a day.
Yeah.
That's real time. That's time I could spend sleeping, fully unconscious instead of only half unconscious. No, but that's time I could read a book. I could learn an instrument. If you spent an hour a day learning an instrument, you could play the instrument in the end of a year, right?
Yeah.
I spent an hour a day doing The Simpsons. I got nothing but a blister on my finger.
And you lost a lot of donuts.
Yes, you know about the donuts.
I should have said that. Sorry.
No.
I know that's a sore point.
It's not the money, actually. I thought about it. Okay, so maybe I spent like $100 playing this stupid game. But it wasn't the money. It was the time. Hours a week. Anyway, I'm very glad that I'm proud of myself. So if you catch me tapping and staring and going, ha, 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 you slap me. And, you know, I'm thinking, I guess what I did do is I took Facebook off my phone, off my tablet. It's not on any mobile device. So I won't spend time when I'm, you know, like you in the line or something doing that. I feel like we're all kind of slaves to this stuff sometimes. And it's really useful. It's really great to have a computer in your pocket all the time. I'm at a movie and I want to know, what was she in? She looks so familiar and I can look that up. People yell at me, but that's okay. I can live with that. Who should we talk to? First call of the day, Heather.
This will make you so happy.
Are you manipulating me?
I am, with choosing good calls. Mackenzie in Grand Rapids, you're going to help him spend his money.
Ah, I do like doing that. Hi, Mackenzie. Leo Laporte,
hey, DTK. Hey, how's it going, Leo?
It's going great. What's up?
Not much. I'm starting a business up. I'm going to be working with some 3D printers and some CAD software, and I'm looking, my business partner wants touchscreen, so we're just looking at some laptops, because I'm going to be mainly running it, so I'll be going from my warehouse to his.
And does he want touchscreen to do the CAD, or does he just want touchscreen as the operating system?
Partially, not necessarily with the CAD, but some of the 3D printing software offers kind of CNC-type controls, where when you're sitting next to the printer, you can manually control it.
Yeah, it would be nice to be able to do that by touching the screen. People who do CAD and stuff where there's drafting, there's engineering, there's design, often use what's called a Cintiq. That's from a display from Wacom, Wacom, that actually is a computer display that you can touch, and it makes anything touch capable. Because I don't know, you know, if you're using, I don't know what you use, but let's say you're using AutoCAD.
Yep.
It may not be touch enabled even on Windows. It might be hard to use touch enabled. I guess you could get Windows 8.1. Make your partner happy.
Okay. I was thinking of I didn't know which laptop to go to, is more or less. I was looking at the S7, which I heard you recommend, or the Carbon X1.
Both are excellent. It really depends what you're looking for. Lenovo, the Carbon X1 Touch, make sure you get the Touch one, is a great business machine. It's robust. It sounds like this is not going to be, portability is not critical on this, right?
I'd rather have functionality more than portability, right. But I will be transferring with at least one of the machines that we get.
The Acer S7, which is the Windows 8 tablet laptop I use and I really like, is super thin and light. So it's excellent for portability. But as a result, you sacrifice a few things. For instance, I feel like the keyboard could be better. It's so thin that you can't have a lot of distance traveled in the keys, and that makes it harder for me anyway to touch type. Whereas Lenovo is a little thicker and has a much better keyboard. In fact, Lenovo's ThinkPads are famous for keyboards. They also have that little track point, the little rubber eraser in the middle of the keyboard. A lot of people like that. I never use it, but if it's something you're used to.
The military, working on some documents in the military.
Yeah, so you're probably used to what do they use?
They have a lot of ThinkPads.
Yeah. ThinkPad is the kind of, it's funny because it's owned by China now. I imagine that lately they haven't been buying a lot of Lenovo products, but that doesn't bother me. I think there's some really excellent ThinkPad choices out there. I have a ThinkPad, is it the W series? This thing is it's a monster. It's a mobile workstation, which means it is basically a desktop replacement. And so less portable. It's, it's heavy to carry around, but it's got a big display. It's in Ultra HD now. They have 4K displays. So these are really nice.
Which one is that, Leo, that you have?
I think it's the W line. I can't remember. The W is their workstation line. It's at home, or I would.
Because I'd seen otherwise I'd seen the Yoga, because I know that flips around.
Yeah, so you're
for more of a tablet type.
Yeah,
style.
When you're doing the Yoga, that's because you want more of a tablet style. You got to ask your partner. What are you looking for?
Probably the X1, or maybe even check out their workstation.
Well, given that you're doing CAD, you're doing 3D design, you're going to want that workstation power. The problem is it's just not very portable.
Yeah.
But boy, they're great screens. They're big screens. They have very high-end Intel processors, lots of RAM. They're the kind of thing you would use instead of a desktop to do things like 3D design.
Definitely. I mean, I have my MacBook Pro that I bought in 2010, but unfortunately, some of the software I'm going to be using is not compatible with Mac and an older MacBook Pro. So,
somebody in the chat room says that WinMate, I'm not familiar with them, make industrial touchscreen computers. They might be worth looking at if you're going to use it in a production environment. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number. 888-827-5536. When I talk about stuff, we put it in the show notes, and that is at techguylabs.com. But that's not all that's there. The phone number's there. The link to the chat room, and I'd love to have you in there. And plus, audio and video from all our previous shows, plus written answers to all the questions, and your comments, too, which is very valuable if you comment on there. That adds to the value, especially if you disagree. Or you know of a different way or a better way to do what we were talking about, put that in the comments, would you? TechGuyLabs.com. Always open, always free, no subscription necessary. TechGuyLabs.com. And yes, we will never email you. First I thought when I read that Canadian anti-spam law and the $10 million fine, I thought, are we sending? And then I realized we don't send out emails of any kind. Sponsors are always saying, can we get in your newsletter? I don't have a newsletter. Everybody else has a newsletter. Rush has a newsletter. Hannity has a newsletter. Bill O'Reilly has a newsletter. Kim Komando has it. But I don't have a newsletter. I just, I'm too lazy, I guess. Also, I don't like to charge for stuff. And now, I'm glad, because I don't have to worry about a Canadian anti-spam suit. Brian Santa Anna, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Leo. Okay, I've got a custom-built gaming PC that I built myself a few years ago, and recently it's developed a rather strange bug. Whenever I shut down properly, the power button won't work to bring it back on unless I press and hold the power button for several seconds or tap reset a few times, in which case the speakers will sort of pop, and then the power button will
start. Yeah, that's working. A real power. And what's happening when you do that is you're powering down and powering back up. So What's not happening when you're shutting down is it's not shutting down. It's not turning itself off fully. This is so common, by the way. It's almost endemic in Windows. It could be a number of things. So when you do a shutdown, the screen goes off.
Screen goes off. Fans go down.
Fans go down, off. It's hard drive. You just nothing. It's like as if it's off.
I can't say about the hard drive because I don't have one. I'm all solid state now. Okay.
But the problem is that you can't turn it back on again with the on-off switch unless you press and hold it, which is a full off, right? That's a hardware turn off.
Right. That's why I'm wondering if this is a hardware problem or a software problem because it's kind of driving me nuts.
Anybody in the chat room have a suggestion about this? I see these kinds of problems all the time, and I can talk about a number of reasons it happens. Sometimes when you install, especially on a self-built machine, sometimes when you install Windows, for instance, the Windows installer chooses the wrong kernel. There's one that supports automatic power control, and there's one that doesn't. You may have switched either the jumpers or the actual wires to the power switch.
Checked that already.
You already did. Okay. James says, just pull the power plug. You'll know it's off. Actually, I'm curious. If you do this normal shutdown, and you're doing it from the start menu, right? You shut down the computer.
Correct.
You're doing a software shutdown. If you do this and then you unplug the computer, does anything more happen?
I'd have to test to find out.
Here's what I would do. I would test that. I would say, this will tell you whether it's what's going on a little bit more. So do the normal power down. Wait a minute. Let it just, make sure it's really shut down. Because you don't want to do this unless it's fully shut down. And then unplug it. Now we know it's shut down. There's no power. Wait about 10 seconds. Plug it back in. Now try the on-off switch and see if it works. If it does, then you're not getting a full shutdown in software. If it doesn't, then we do have a hardware wiring issue of some kind. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Or a power switch issue. So what you're doing is you're forcing it to, you're off, machine, you're off. And if you still can't turn it on, well, we know it's not something that you are shutting it down normally. My suspicion is you're not. Because this is the most common thing. Windows often has trouble shutting down. And if you think about it, it's not surprising. What Windows has to do to shut down is a lot. It sends messages to all the programs. I'm shutting down now. I'm going to give you a minute, but you've got to shut down too, because the last thing Windows wants to do is force programs to close. There may be unsaved data. You've seen it before. You shut down the machine. It says, Word pops up saying, hey, you haven't saved your document. That's because Word got a message from the operating system. We're about to shut down. You better make sure all your processes are properly shut down. Word says, whoa, we haven't saved this. It says, save it. And it can actually stop. You've seen this too. It can stop the shutdown. You'll get a message saying, hey, we weren't able to shut down because Word prevented it. All of that's to protect you and the programs from losing data. But it also means that shutdown is somewhat problematic because it's not merely the running programs that has to get shut down. It's processes. It's services running in the background. And sometimes these services can block it, but they don't have a user interface. So, in fact, you may have gotten 90% to shut down. The screen shut off, everything. And then this service is still running, and it won't let Windows really shut down. So you have to push and hold that button, and then that shuts down the service because it forces it. See, that's that kind of shutdown, that forced shutdown is a little more dangerous. You don't normally want to unplug it or force the power down because it doesn't give the computer time, the operating system time to do an orderly shutdown. So there's a few things. Moose in Michigan says turn off fast boot in the power options. You might want to look at what services are running. You can do that in the management console and turn off any services you don't think you need. Maybe the CMOS needs to be reset. This is not uncommon in a home-built computer because you patched it together from a variety of different pieces. And, sometimes that happens. It could be a bad power supply. That's always possible as well. So you can see there's all sorts of things. The good news is because you built this, you probably installed a clean version of Windows. It's not a OEM version with a lot of junkware on it, right?
Nope, full retail copy.
Yeah, that's good. That's actually much better. Some of this comes from antivirus and security software because, remember, they also don't want to just be shut down. Otherwise, a virus would say, I'm the operating system shut down. And then the antivirus shuts down and says, ha-ha, now we're free to do whatever we choose. So all of this is conspiring to make shutdown tricky. You might look in, you know, lots of suggestions from the chat room, which we will put in the show notes at Tech Guy Labs. And the reason there are so many is because there's so many potential causes for this. Hibernation is one of the most notorious problems. I would suggest turning off hibernation if you've got that on. Hibernation is an interesting idea, but it never works very well. You know, there's different sleep states on a modern computer, and this isn't just Windows. It's all modern computers. Of course, there's a full power down. That means once that's completed, no power is being drawn from the circuits, from the mains. You can unplug it. It's nothing's going on. And that means in order to start the computer up, you have to go through the full boot process, the power on self-test, loading in the software, all of that, and that takes a while. So there are other states that aren't quite as shut down. There's, of course, sleep, and you're familiar with that. That just turns off the screen, maybe stops the hard drives if they're spinning drives, you know, puts it in a sleep state. That wakes up right away, and it even uses power because sleep state keeps memory, keeps the RAM refreshed. So it's always taking some power to keep the RAM going, but it's a few watts. It's 8 watts, 9 watts instead of 60 or 70 watts. The next state down from sleep state is hibernate, and this is one that almost never works right. In fact, even on the new Microsoft Surface Pro 3 that just came out, hibernate was broken. And people who let the computer go to sleep, it was waking up, it didn't know what time it was, it was very confused. It would, you know, the battery would be messed up, and all because it was broken. They fixed it right before it shipped, but people who had early versions of it had nasty power problems, and it seemed to be traced back to hibernate. Hibernate, the idea is the computer is going to go to pretty much a full shutdown, but it's going to preserve memory. Remember that RAM needs power to stay active, so we don't want to use RAM. So we're going to save the entire contents, 4 gigs, 8 gigs, 16 gigs to hard drive, then shut down and reload it after hibernate. That almost never works. Turn it off. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the number. If you have a question, a comment, a suggestion, I like to talk high tech. I hope you do too. And I'd love to hear from you. You know, all the attention on the Supreme Court this week was on this Aereo decision, putting Aereo effectively out of business. Supreme Court holding that Aereo is no different than a cable company, that they are performing the works, in effect, and that they would be required to pay retransmission fees just as your cable company is, which seemed to me, actually, to be pretty right on. Aereo was kind of designed to sort of get around that with a very odd loophole. They said, no, we're not a cable company. Each customer gets their own individual antenna. We just rent antennas, and what you do with it is up to you. But, of course, what you're intended to do with it is watch local television over that antenna. ABC and the ABC affiliates sued because they said, well, that's just what a cable company does. Of course, a cable company only has one antenna, and everybody shares it. But effectively, it's the same thing a cable company does. So this is just a clever ploy to get around paying what are called retransmission fees, the fees the cable company pays local channels for the right to put the local channels on the cable. They have to pay it by, interestingly enough, Supreme Court decision many, many moons ago, and by the law, by the Telecommunications Act, I think, of 1976. So that's what the court said. Yep. They are basically a cable company. And in fact, I didn't realize this, but yesterday Scott Wilkinson, our home theater guy, pointed out an article from an antenna expert who said, you know, nobody has mentioned this, and they didn't even mention it in the arguments before the Supreme Court, but ABC probably should have, that this Aereo single antenna thing is a lie. The way antennas work is they have to resonate to the frequency of the channel they want to pick up. That's why you have to, when you have a UHF antenna, it looks different than a VHF antenna and so forth. He says these dime-sized antennas are too small to actually pick up television unless they're like right next to the tower, like in the same building, and the tower can, quote, brute force its way into the antenna. He says much more likely that what's really happening is that these antennas are acting in concert as an array of antennas. And so what Aereo's claiming, which is you're renting a single antenna, really isn't true because it wouldn't work. It's not The physics don't work. Nobody brought that up. And I wish they had, because that kind of changes it. Now is it like a cable company? Yeah, it's even more like a cable company. Nevertheless, this doesn't matter. This decision doesn't matter. It matters to Aereo and Aereo customers, because Aereo probably will either be put out of business or end up charging, and I think this is what's going to happen, charging customers transmission fees. They're going to go back to the lower court that made the ruling and say, hey, if we charge people just like a cable company, would that be okay? And the court will say, well, yeah, of course. And they'll pay the fees, and you'll pay more, because Aereo's cheap. It's $8 a month. You'll have to start paying $20 or $30 a month. You know, this is all in interim because everything's going to be on the internet in 5 years anyway. So none of this is going to matter. This is only a temporary fix because we're in this in-between state between television broadcasting, cable television, and internet television. And can you see the writing on the wall? It's just a matter of time before everything is on the internet. And then it won't matter. You'll be able to watch anything, anywhere, anytime. And that's what you want, isn't it? It's what we want. So this is like a minor blip. Years from now, we'll look back and say, what were we worried about? However, the Supreme Court at the same time released a decision that changes the world, at least in the U.S. They ruled that even if you have been arrested for a crime, law enforcement cannot search the contents of your smartphone without a warrant. That your smartphone is indeed private property. It's personal. And they can't just, as they have been, hook a machine up to it and suck all the data off of it. Law enforcement carries around machines that literally they connect to the USB cable and they go, give me all your stuff. And they've got everything that's on your smartphone. Whether it's germane to the arrest or the prosecution, doesn't matter. The Supreme Court quite rightly ruled, hey, that's illegal. That's improper search and seizure. You got to get a warrant.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And that is more, I think, a much more important and lasting decision from the terms of privacy rights. So, you know, the buggy whip manufacturers lost a case. Actually, they won a case. But that's not going to matter because we're not going to be using buggy whips in a few years anyway. 8888, ask Leo, that's the phone number. We're going to get back to the phones in a second with Dave in Los Banos. Wants to talk about another very big issue that's going around these days. This little thing called net neutrality. Or as John Oliver calls it, and I will paraphrase, cable company chicanery. He used a different word, but you get the idea. He says, it's not net neutrality. We're just trying to stop cable company chicanery. I think that's probably right in this case. Dave in Los Banos, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Dave.
Hello, Leo. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
I am staying nice and cool. I hadn't heard it for a couple of weeks, and I just kind of wanted to bring it up because I know the deadline's coming close with the FCC on the net neutrality issues. And, you know, first off, obviously, I want to thank you for all the programming that you've had on your network for, you know, bringing the different views up. And in particular, I took from your Security Now conversation with the fact of the plights of the smaller ISPs,
yeah,
as opposed to the big three. And I think there is definitely an unlevel playing field between them. And I definitely think the FCC should take some kind of control over the big three, what kind of formula they use to state that, I don't know. But
well, you can't discriminate against three ISPs and not against the rest. You have to apply rules to everybody. Let me explain what net neutrality. I understand what you're saying, and we talked to Brett Glass, who is a small wireless ISP in Laramie, Wyoming, and he said I can't afford to work as an ISP unless I charge companies like Netflix for access to my customers. And I understand it's because the kind of service he's offering is very expensive, and to offer the kind of speed he needs to offer for Netflix is very costly. But frankly, the fact that he's unwilling and his customers are unwilling to pay that price and expects Netflix to pay it is a little weird. And I had this conversation. What we're going to do is we're going to do a net neutrality special. We're going to put together all the different conversations we've had into one audio bit that you can listen to and kind of get caught up. I also recommend John Oliver. He's got a new TV show on HBO, but I think you can find this on YouTube. If you search for John Oliver and net neutrality, now the language is fairly adult, but he makes some really excellent points. And I think explains net neutrality. The issue that an internet service provider should not be able to discriminate, should not be able to block content. You should be able to get on the internet using your ISP and see everything. Is, I think, fairly important. Let me talk about it more when we come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. We talk tech. We talk computers. We talk the internet. We talk space. I'll throw that in. Just a freebie. Going to Mars. Let's talk about it. We can also talk about smartphones. Our photographer guru, Chris Marquardt, is back from his cruise, the digital photography expert, the myth buster in digital photography. He'll be joining us at 33 and a third after the hour. Talk about photography and answer some questions you have. But meanwhile, I'm answering questions now at 8888-ASK-LEO. And we were talking with Dave in Los Banos about net neutrality, and I wanted to kind of finish that thought. So the FCC has published new rules. This is a long and complicated story. I've talked about it before. It's important, I think, because the internet is so important. As we talk about every show, what a change the internet is bringing to our world, and I would say absolutely for the better. It's putting information at your fingertips. It's allowing everybody to have a voice. It's changed how we shop. It's changed how we communicate. It changed how we work, how we play, how we worship. It is a phenomenal force in our society. And because it's been so valuable, particularly in the United States in terms of innovation, of improving our lives, it's important to protect it. We have to protect it because we don't want commercial interests to take over the internet and turn it into, you know, a giant Facebook, something to their benefit and not to ours. That's basically what net neutrality is about. It's about preserving the fundamental operating agreement on the internet that bits are bits, that every bit on the internet travels equally, freely, without being impeded by anybody along the way. So if you're listening to this show on the internet, it should arrive in your computer just as fast, just as easily, just as freely as a web page, as your email. That's net neutrality, and it's how the internet was designed. Unfortunately, things have happened on the internet that have raised some interesting issues. For instance, Netflix. Many of us love to watch TV and movies over Netflix. Great deal, $8 a month, and you have unlimited movies and TV from their limited collection, but you can watch as much as you want. And it now is so successful, it uses about 40% of all internet traffic in prime time. And companies, the big internet service providers in the United States, who mostly are Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, they're phone companies and they're big, big businesses. They've said, well, you are using 40% of our bandwidth, so we want you to pay the costs of upgrading our facilities. The issue, of course, I have as a customer is, well, I'm also paying them to upgrade. I'm paying them for internet service, and presumably I should be paying them enough for them to be making a good living. We are, by the way, that it's a profitable business. It is, by the way, and they shouldn't have to go to Netflix and ask for money hat in hand, or YouTube, or anybody else. I'm paying for access to the internet. Just because they control that last mile to my house doesn't mean Comcast should be a toll keeper and say, hey, if you would like to reach Leo, you're going to have to pay us a little extra. And that's the fundamental debate. The FCC did promulgate an open internet series of regulations and rules. The court, Verizon sued, and the court just a few months ago threw them out. Said to the FCC, you don't have the authority. Congress has not given you the authority to regulate the internet this way. So the FCC went back to the table and has proposed new rules, and among some of the features of the new rules, there are some good things, but among them are the idea that some of the edge providers, the Netflixes, the YouTubes, and little people like me, I'm an internet broadcaster, is why I have some great interest in this, let's use me as an example, that if we start, you know, that if the companies want to, they can charge us for fast lane access to their consumers, to their customers. That Comcast can not only charge you for access to the internet, but charge me for access to you. And many of us feel this is wrong. The real challenge is, how do you fix it? And I think many of us have come to also the conclusion that the last thing we want is for the heavy-handed government rules to get involved here, because that could be even more damaging to the internet. But it's hard to figure out. I mean, the best way to fix it would be for there to be real competition. There isn't in the U.S. Look at your situation. In most cases, we have one choice, maybe two, a cable company and a phone company, both of whom are big companies who want to do this. We don't have a third choice, a feisty little internet service provider who will say, I'm not going to monitor, measure, or meter. You can get full and free access to the internet at one flat rate. Most of us don't have that. If we did, I think I wouldn't worry. I think competition would handle this. Free market would take care of this. But the FCC many years ago made sure it wasn't a free market. So that's what we've got to figure out. We've got to find a way to make this fair and to keep the internet alive. And that's what the debate is about. If you want to read more about it, there are lots of good sources on both sides of it. And a search for net neutrality will deliver them. As I said, that John Oliver piece is fantastic. The Electronic Frontier Foundation has been around for many, many years protecting our rights in the digital world. They have a page on net neutrality that explains it better than I just did and what the issues were. And where discrimination has happened, and what the FCC is doing and has proposed, and more, most importantly, what you can do. But that's one of many. I think the internet's pretty important. I think it is something that has transformed the world, and I think it needs to be protected. I think reasonable people may have a debate over how best to do this. Therein lies the difficulty in figuring out how to solve this problem. 8888 Ask Leo is the phone number. I'd love to hear from you what you think about this, Dave. Did I fairly state it?
I you did. And one thing which I would like to maybe toss out as a thought is not so much in the regulating of the ISPs as far as what they can do, but make those three major ISPs, have them give the equivalency of dry loops that the smaller ISPs, such as Dane and such as the wireless ISP that was mentioned, can come out and actually provide service to other customers.
Yeah, that's a real problem, too, is the phone companies are not supportive of the internet, the independent internet service providers like DSL Extreme and SonicNet and so forth. Another good place to go if you want to know more is there's a very good website called SaveTheInternet.com. That's pretty much an advocacy group for encouraging the FCC to regulate, and they do have a number of ways you can communicate with the FCC. I suggest learning as much as you can before you make a decision about what should be done. It's complicated. And unfortunately, it requires a knowledge not only of technology and of how the internet works, but of politics. Because unless we have a solution that works politically, it doesn't really matter. You can also email your thoughts to the FCC at openinternet@fcc.gov. But I would suggest before you do that, learning as much as you can. But do something, because this is so important. We really want to make sure we preserve this thing that has transformed the world and made it a better place. As you know, I'm a big fan. My business is a broadcasting. Besides the radio show, what I do during the week is broadcast on the internet. So keeping a free and open internet is a very big deal for me. 8888 Ask Leo. Thank you for raising the issue, Dave. And I know I sometimes go on and on this, and it's complicated. It's abstruse. It's probably not, you know, something that hits you day to day, except that it will in the long run. So I think it's worth spending some time on. But we will continue on. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. Back to the phones we go. JR from Hewitt, Texas. Hi, JR.
Hey, Leo, how you doing, boss?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, doing pretty good. I bought a new Lenovo desktop and ordered it. It's a business computer, and I bought me a real nice Dell 29-inch monitor for it. And I got it all hooked up. It was last November, I think. And I started, every once in a while, I'd add a program to it and not pay any attention. I just assumed it went on the solid-state hard drive. It's got a 280-gig hard drive, a solid-state hard drive,
uh-huh.
and a 1-terabyte data drive.
Oh, nice.
And then all of a sudden, I get this error message up from Lenovo. Says, well, your partition's nearly full. And I go, what? It didn't ask me where I wanted to do it. I just assumed it.
Well, unfortunately, installing programs on Windows almost always requires that they be installed. I mean, you can move them to, you can install them on a different drive, like the D drive, that one that has all that space. But
yeah.
Unless you say otherwise, it almost always gets installed in a folder in the same drive as Windows. And frankly, it works best that way. I rarely recommend trying to put programs on a separate drive. But you're right, that can cause congestion. That terabyte drive is really intended for data and data only. And that's normally data is what takes up all the space, videos, music files, photographs. And 228 gigs is usually enough for Windows and all the apps. You must have installed a lot of stuff.
No, not really. It went into the partition on the solid-state drive.
So okay. So tell me. So the solid-state drive is partitioned. How is it partitioned?
I think 30% or 20% is the recovery
right.
for Windows.
Right. That's normal nowadays. Yeah.
Right. And then I
it's not installing him in the recovery partition. It's installing him in the C drive, right?
No, it's putting it in the recovery partition.
Well, that's goofy.
Yes, and I called Lenovo, and they said, well, it can't do that. And I said, well, it did it.
Yeah, normally that recovery partition is non-writable, and it's not even visible.
Right, well, guess
what? Sure it's putting it that stuff there?
That's what the warning arrow comes up, because the solid-state hard drive's 280 gigs.
Yeah, the recovery partition is usually just big enough, not a lot of free space, just big enough to hold Windows, the recovery Windows install.
Right. Well, I haven't added that.
I think you're misreading. I frankly think you're misreading what it's doing. I can't understand why it would be. It isn't even possible. So you're looking, when you look at free space on your hard drive, on your internal hard drive, or your C drive.
Yeah.
What do you see? Free space.
Everything on the other side of the solid state drive is empty.
Yeah, the D drive. Okay, so you have a C and a D. Am I right?
I have the partition, and then the
partition doesn't have a drive letter because it's an invisible partition. So, what are the drive letters you see? When you open my computer, what are the drive letters? C and D.
C and D.
Yeah. D is the terabyte data drive. C is where stuff goes. You can't even put stuff on the install partition. It doesn't have a letter.
Well, somehow it ended up there because I keep getting this error message, and Lenovo doesn't speak the same brand of English that I do. You know, they're
all right. So my guess, unless you did something very, very weird, and I don't think you did, is that Lenovo made the recovery partition too small. It's not much bigger. It's a few megabytes bigger than what it needs. So anything would give you that error message. My suspicion is all of your data is being stored on the C drive. There's no way to install a program on a drive that doesn't have a letter. It just won't work. So unless you're actively trying, you haven't given a letter to the recovery partition. You'd have to make it an active part. It's not. So I think everything's installed on the C drive. It's just tight on the recovery partition. What is the error message saying?
It says that the recovery partition is nearly full.
Yeah. Well, you don't care about that. You didn't mount it, did you? No, you didn't mount it. You didn't mess around with the partitioning in any way.
No. No, I know better than that.
So I think if you tell what you told Lenovo was what you told me, that's going to confuse them. It isn't because you're installing programs there. They're not going there. They're going to the C drive. There's no way to install them there. But they didn't give you enough space on the recovery partition, and for whatever reason, it's so tight that you're getting an error message.
Oh, okay.
But it's not because you're installing stuff there. There's no way to install stuff there because you can't. Now, make sure you're putting data on the D drive. I'm sure you're doing that, like documents and my documents and all of that stuff.
Photographs.
Yeah. You shouldn't be getting a warning. I think that's an error. It isn't something you can do anything about or should do anything about. I think the error message might be coming from, are you sure it's coming from Windows?
No, it's coming from Lenovo software.
Yeah, something wrong with that Lenovo software.
I got another question too, if you don't mind, if you got a second.
Yeah, and I'm just going to chat room. If you can help me, anybody has a Lenovo and has seen this, just let me know where are we getting this error message from. And it would be, I think, safe to disable this. So you want to go in that Lenovo program and just say, don't give me warnings about the recovery partition. The recovery partition is always almost full. That's how they design it. They don't want to waste space. So the error message is spurious. It's meaningless. Okay. And you shouldn't see that error message, and you just should turn that error message off. And I suspect that somewhere in the Lenovo settings, there's a place you can say, "Hey, don't stop warning me about this.
Yeah, leave me alone.
Leave me alone. There's nothing wrong. It's normal. It's normal."
Hey, I'm not too good with smartphones. I bought one a few months ago, and I had to go back to my flip phone. I bought that Samsung Rugby 2.
Yeah,
but I saw one the other day, the Samsung Mega.
Yeah,
what do you think of that?
It's big. it's essentially a Galaxy S4 that is put in a ginormous phone. I think it's 6 inches. It's huge. Have you seen it?
Oh yeah, I went and looked at one. I was looking at the new S5. Active, which has got a whole bunch of crap on it.
The S5 Active is waterproof. Well, that's why it's active. Yeah, unless you plan to go swimming with your phone, I wouldn't worry about that.
Well, I'm an over-the-road truck driver, and I'm hard on phones. They get wet. They fall in the dog's bowl. And
then you do want it. Do you take a dog on the road with you?
Huh?
You take a dog on the road?
Well, he passed away not too long ago, but he was in the truck with me for 18 and a half years.
I have a fix for you. I found it. Hold on. We'll talk about it when we come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Chris Marquardt's back from his cruise. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Leo.
Chris is our digital photography guru. He's the creator of a great Lightroom course, discoverlightroom.com, and his podcast, Tips from the Top Floor, is one of the longest running photography podcasts out there. And actually, before we get to the topic on hand, I thought I might mention that Apple announced on Friday it was discontinuing Aperture. So
yes,
Aperture, like Lightroom, is a professional photography tool designed to help you manage your workflow, manage your photos, modify them, publish them. That kind of thing. A lot of pros used Aperture because it came with Macintosh, but the writing's been on the wall for a while. They hadn't updated it in years.
Yeah, they've been kind of not doing anything with it. But I mean, it doesn't mean it'll disappear from your computer right away. So you can
still use it. They just won't update it. Yeah.
And they said that they are going to work to replace all of that with the new Photos app. So
yeah, but the new Photos app doesn't sound like a pro app. It sounds like iPhoto. Frankly.
Yeah, but we only saw a glimpse of that, so I'm not sure. And then, I think Adobe will do a lot now to kind of catch all those users with Lightroom. So
I moved to Lightroom a long time ago, partly because I kept trying Aperture, especially when Apple made it $80. That was I thought, well, gosh, Lightroom was at the time $300. Maybe I should really move to Aperture, but it never really took for me, and I'm glad I stuck with Lightroom because Adobe's keeping that alive.
Even though I mean Aperture is a very powerful piece of software still, but yeah, Lightroom, I've been using Lightroom from the first beta, so I'm one of the early adopters there, and I just know it in and out, so that's why I'm using it.
What do you think? I mean, you said there was some controversy. What's going on?
I think they do the same thing that they're doing in other areas. They're trying to consolidate because right now they have iPhoto. They have iPhoto on the Mac, iPhoto on the iPhone. They have Photos on the iPhone. They have Aperture on the Mac. So I think they're just trying to consolidate this and to make this one experience, especially when with the next version of iOS, we're going to be able to hand off things from a computer to the right. phone and so on. So I think if you're working on a photo, they want to enable you to go over to your computer and continue working on the photo right there.
Right.
So
that makes sense.
With the current software, that's not possible. So I think they have to kind of shrink it down a bit.
If they even say they're killing iPhoto, that it's all going to be photos
going forward. Yes.
I do have to say that Lightroom has a very compelling story. If you use an iPad, the Lightroom app on the iPad, Lightroom on your desktop, whether it's Windows or Mac, they sync up.
iPhone too.
And they now have it on the iPhone. And I think whatever Apple does, Lightroom is clearly the future. It's certainly for me. It's really good.
Well, I hate to see Adobe getting some sort of a monopoly here. I think competition is important here. So I really hope that the new Photos app will have professional features. And I really hope that it will be there to kind of help keep Lightroom in check and keep the quality up and keep the competition up.
Yeah, competition is very important. So we have a photo assignment. It's still going on, right?
It's still going on. I want to review that next Sunday.
So your last week...
Yes, it's the last week. The assignment is cornered.
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 So the idea of these assignments is you take a picture illustrating the word, the concept, the idea, cornered, upload it to Flickr. We have a tech guy group there. You'll know you're in the tech guy group when you see 11,419 members, 3,741 photos. Doesn't cost you anything to do this. And we're getting some great cornered pictures. But we're going to pick... one of those. I love that one. The chess one is great. We're going to pick one of those. So make sure you get to upload a picture this week. Make sure you tag it cornered. And we'll pick three to review next week on the show. What do you want to talk about this week?
Well, you know, the guys in the chat room who always have good answers and good questions and things. I decided this week to do a little chat room Q&A special.
Ah. So
about an hour, 1.5 hours ago, I threw the question in there and said, give me your questions, and if I get enough, I'll do this. And they delivered.
Oh,
so,
boy, did they. I'm sure, yeah.
So I have a bunch of questions here from the chat room. Let's start with Beatmaster. Beatmaster asks, what's the best settings to photograph a moonlit beach?
A moonlit beach.
Yes, a moonlit beach. Now, quick answer here. If you want to include the moon, then there is no single photo you can take. You have to kind of do a composite because the moon is so much brighter than the beach. For that, to find out the good exposure for the moon, put Looney 11 in your Google search and it'll spit out kind of a little formula for you. If it's just the moonlit beach itself without the moon, you want to use a high ISO. You want to use a bright lens, like a lens that lets lots of light in, like a 51.8, for example. A tripod will help you. And then you can take great long exposures of waves and things. They can be really beautiful. Like if you take a several second exposure of the waves on the beach, you get this hazy, dreamlike kind of feeling there. And that's how I would approach that.
This is an example of what we call high dynamic range, possibly, right? You might make a composite picture, or you might do... because you're going to have a darker beach, a brighter moon, and normally you don't have that much dynamic range in a picture.
And that is the next question, actually, by user iPad19732. He asked, HDR on or off? So I asked him what kind of a camera. So he's using a smartphone, and that would be a high dynamic range situation where you might want to try to play with that setting. It's for high contrast situations. So if the sun is out, there's this saying, the brightest light makes the blackest mark. So you have a really bright sun out there. You have lots of very dark shadows. That's where, and on or off, there is no yes or no answer to this one. Use HDR, try it out, see what it does, how it reacts in different situations, especially in these very high dynamic, very crisp light situations with lots of direct light, maybe backlit portraits, these kind of things, indoor situations with bright windows, that's high dynamic range. So those are the situations where HDR mode can be quite good, actually.
Next week in the U.S., we have a little event coming up that's going to kind of challenge photographers, and particularly this issue of light and dark fireworks, the 4th of July.
Oh, yeah, but HDR mode is not the right one for that because fireworks are...
They move.
They move. And the thing with HDR is the way it does it is it takes multiple pictures in succession and then kind of computationally puts those together. And moving fireworks might get some interesting artistic effects there. So shooting fireworks with a smartphone, there are a few apps like the Slow Shutter app for iPhone that can kind of help you there. But that's tripod material with long exposures.
I've had good results, actually, with smartphones and fireworks for some reason. I don't know why.
Well, maybe by now they are smart enough to detect that that's his fireworks and act accordingly. That's...
How about if you've got a point-and-shooter or even a SLR? What should you do for fireworks? You said a tripod?
Well, you put it on a tripod. You put it on a small aperture so you have lots in focus.
And you open and up the shutter and just let it sit?
Well, what you do, if you have a remote release, like a wired release or something, you open up the shutter. And then what you want to do is take a hat and hold it in front of the camera. So while the rockets go up, they don't show the streak. And then as soon as they are up, take the hat off and it'll expose just a big bloom kind of thing.
Brilliant. So because I'm packing for Hawaii tonight, so because I got to be ready for the 4th of July, I'm going to bring a hat.
Hat helps. Speaking of packing, Shivers asked, how do you store your cameras while backpacking? So you know I do backpack and... I take the camera with me.
Real quick. But
I'm unconventional. I travel light. I have a light day pack, and I put protective wraps around my lenses.
Chris Marquardt, discoverlightroom.com. Thank you, sir. Leo Laborde,
sure.
The tech guy. Leo Laborde, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo. Fun talking about digital photography. I'm going to Hawaii. Going to be the 4th of July. Going to be there. I'm going to take underwater pictures of fishes. With my GoPro, I'm excited. And travel for me is just an opportunity to take pictures, frankly. The rest of it is a pain in the butt. I need to bring a big bag of camera gear. That's all I need. We talked to JR from Hewitt, Texas. By the way, Sarah, so sorry about your dog, JR. I just want to reiterate that the warning you're getting, unless something is saving to that partition, which normally the recovery partition is not even accessible, that warning, you just turn that off. Find the software that Lenovo put on there to warn you and just say, I don't want to know, because it's full. It should be full, but you're not putting anything more there. And as far as the Galaxy Mega, the only negative on the Galaxy Mega is that for the size, it doesn't have the super high resolution. I think it's 720p. And that's one of the reasons it's less expensive. You might look at the Galaxy Note 3 as well. Also very large, not quite as large as the Mega, but a better resolution and in many ways a better screen, a better phone, you know, better stuff. I've gotten off the Samsung platform mostly because of all the stuff Samsung does to it. It's like the bad old days of the PC. Remember, you'd buy a PC from HP or somebody and it'd be just loaded with trialware and stuff. And nowadays, the smartphones, they do that too, and it bugs me. I was actually somewhat relieved to hear that with the Google Android stuff they announced this week at Google I.O., Android Wear, Android Car, Android TV. In all three cases, Google is going to insist that the people who make the hardware do not change the user interface, do not add junkware, their own versions of programs and things like that. That's good news. They'll all be updated automatically from Google, not from the phone company or the cable company. Google will keep it up to date. And that's good for developers, too, because they know exactly what they're going to be writing software for. They know exactly how it's going to be running, what version of the operating system, and so forth. I think that's very good news. 8888 Ask Leo. MJ in Burbank, California is next. Hey, MJ.
Hey there. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my gosh. You're on. What can I do for you?
And let me turn down the radio.
Yeah. I'm sorry we keep you on hold so long, but it's because I'm just kind of a windbag, frankly.
No, it's all good. The whole website neutrality was really, really eye-opening.
Good, good.
I am in the process of buying a Mac. I can't afford a brand new Mac, so I've been looking at refurbished Macs.
Now, if you're going to get refurbished, for a Mac or anything else, get it from the original manufacturer. Do not buy a refurbished Mac from anybody but Apple.
No, okay, because I found a Mac enthusiast in Santa Monica, and they seem to be...
That's it. You know, I love those guys.
Oh, you love those guys?
Yeah, they're different. But it's generally I don't recommend it. The nice thing about Mac enthusiasts, you can go back to them. They're going to stand behind it. And in some ways, you're even better off than getting it from Apple because they stand behind. They're a good group. So that's a little different. But normally, what I tell people is go to the app. Apple has on the Apple Store a refurbished section, and you can save a little. You know, you don't save as much as you might going to a third party. But the problem with a third party is the warranty is now from the third party, not from Apple. It may be older equipment. It may not be well refurbished. So it's really important when you get a refurbished computer that it's been done by somebody who really knows what they're doing. In this case, you're safe.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. So my homework has paid off.
Yeah, they're good. They're good guys. They are enthusiasts. They love the Mac, and you're nearby, so you can go there and you can get help from them. That's a little different. Usually, there's different kinds of refurbished. The kind of refurbished I like is something that was sold, opened, and returned immediately. Now the law says you can't sell that as new anymore. It's now used, even if it was very lightly used, maybe even never turned on, just the box was open. Those companies, the original companies that sold them, will resell as refurbed or open box, or, you know, they can't sell it as new. In that case, I think you're getting basically this. If it's the same model year and same, you know, stuff they're selling right now, and they have the same warranty, that's as good as new. And so you save a few $100, that's great. There's also refurbishment. There's a store, well-known store, computer store, that was refurbishing hard drives. So they would get hard drives that weren't working, had been returned for whatever reason, and they would, quote, refurbish them and resell them as new. That is the kind of refurb you do not want. You don't want to put your data on something that's been returned because it was malfunctioning. So that's why refurb isn't always a good deal. It really depends on who's doing it, what kind of warranty you get, is it late model, what kind of wear it, tear it received before it got to you. It's like buying a used car. Buying refurb Macs from Apple or refurb Dells from Dell, that's different. Often that's just stuff that was open but can't be resold as new. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Glenda, Orange County. Hi, Glenda. Leo Laporte here.
Oh, hi. I was calling about, first of all, I walk dogs and transport pets for, and I groom animals, too, for people. And I would like to use a GPS tracker when I walk the dogs or transport them and have the client be able to see where the dog is.
What a great idea.
But I don't know how to do that.
Any
I don't
smart?
Know what I need, and I don't know what they need.
Okay, so you want them to be also to be able to see it in real time, like there's where Glenda and the dog are.
Yeah, just in case they're concerned, you know.
Yeah, I think it's a nice idea. Most smartphones can do it. There's a great Google app called Google Tracker that's free, and will track you as you move around, and then you can save that track. And give it to a client, but for real time tracking, then maybe you're going to have to use something different. There's a program called Glimpse that would work, and I want to thank the chat room for suggesting this.
Glimpse.
That's an Android and iPhone, and what that does is what it's nominally for is sending a text message to somebody because you're running late, saying I'm on my way, and then they can watch you on the map as you get closer.
Mm-hmm.
And you could do that with your clients, that you could say, hey, if you'd like, I'll send you a link to where we are. And they open that link on their computer. It launches Google Maps, and there's a real-time dot as you and Fido move around.
Okay.
Isn't that good?
Is there, like, a real-time video?
Sure. Why not? Yeah.
Running around.
Well, are you walking around?
Yes, and I walk the dogs off leash, not all the time, but I do. And so the owners are always like, "How can you be doing that?" And so when they see it, It's like, oh.
Well, you certainly, you know, Garmin and others sell little dog collar GPS trackers you could put on the dog. Then it would show where the dog is, not where you are.
Uh-huh.
And you could buy one and just, but see, for the video, let's see, think about the video. I mean, you can do all this with a smartphone. You can have the Glimpse running. You can have Google's My Tracks running, so you have an after-the-fact map. And you can have the video camera recording. But, there are Ustream allows you to stream live from the phone. There are others. Ustream. Tell you what, we're going to take a break when we come back. All right, I'll put it in the chat room. I mean the website, techguylabs.com. We'll give you three or four places you could do this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. I've just been handing around my... Actually, Heather, I want you to try this, the new Google experience. It's called Cardboard. And...
Did you build a pinhole camera?
It's the strangest thing in the world. So the idea is... And I think this is Google, a little bit of a jab at Facebook, which spent how much money on Oculus Rift? Millions, right? Billions. I can't remember what the total amount was.
Yeah.
But so for all the attendees at Google's developer conference, Google I.O., they got to, you know, people go to Google I.O., get all excited about the hardware that you're going to receive. And,
oh my God.
And in this case, under the chair goodie was this cardboard thing. It was all folded up. One of my co-hosts on our This Week in Google podcast brought me one back. You assemble it, and then you slide your smartphone into it. And once you do that, you've got this cardboard visor you put over your eyes. Your smartphone has a stereo viewer in it. But the interesting thing is, because a smartphone has an accelerometer, as you move your head... The view moves, just like an Oculus Rift. So you can look up, you can look down, you can look left, right. Is it working for you?
I guess, but who cares?
Well, there's other things you... Oh, don't drop my phone out of it. Now I care. There's other things you can look at. You're looking at that mask, a tribal mask, right? But there's other things. You can look at the Earth. You can look at maps. You can play games. It's kind of amazing. And they had a website that'll do it. That's all right. Give it back to me. She's not worthy.
It's boring.
Oh, you're so not worthy.
Am I doing something wrong?
You're like, no, you're not. What
I
you're
saw
looking
the
at
mask
is
head swivel. What like, you're, big
oh,
deal.
Now see, this is the good one.
Oh.
This is you got the good one. This is the bug. The bug. So what you see, if you just look at your phone, they have it on the web, but they have an app called Cardboard in the Google Store. So what you see on the phone is a stereo view. If you just take the phone out of the cardboard, you have left and right eye views. But if you put it in the cardboard, of course, that divides it up. I noticed that there's an opening for the camera, which tells me that at some point they might do augmented reality, a picture of the real world with stuff laid on top of it. But if you just play this, so did you play the bug game? So you're looking around for a bug. Wait a minute, I got to find him. He's here somewhere. And once you... anyway, it's... All right. Maybe it is dumb. But so is Oculus Rift. Because I'll tell you what. This does exactly the same thing as the headset that Facebook bought.
But that was the point.
I think.
We can dumb it down and do it
cheap. I'm thinking that was Google's kind of a dig at Oculus and Facebook was, well...
I like a good dig.
what this was somebody's 20% project. You know about that at Google? All Google employees are expected to do... what they call a 20% project. Here's a tour guide. Let's see what that is. A 20% project. They take 20% of their Google time and they work on stuff. Now, see, this is good. This is Versailles. Here, give this to her. Take a look. This is Versailles. It's as if you're at Versailles. You're looking around. As you move your head, you see different parts.
Okay.
I don't know.
I just don't want to break your phone again.
Don't drop my phone. Just keep, hold the thing on. Don't turn it sideways.
Wedge in a little bit better.
Probably should.
Oh, okay. Now I'm liking it.
Now you see what I'm saying?
This is more my speed.
Look down. See, you can see the ground. Look up. You can see the sky.
Why don't I see my feet?
Because you're not really there. That's the amazing part.
Where's Prince Charming?
It's kind of a neat, I think it's a kind of a neat idea. But what I really love is, you know, they're basically mocking Facebook for spending so
That's
much money.
That's my favorite part.
I'm trying to remember what they spent for. It was several billion, wasn't it, for Oculus Rift? And you know, this headpiece is very expensive. It's kind of heavy. It's a head-mounted display. This is a piece of cardboard. Facebook paid $2 billion for Oculus Rift. They could have spent $1.50 and bought a piece of cardboard, put a phone in there. It's a digital ViewMaster. That's exactly what it is. 88. Now I can't get it back. Suddenly, Heather sees the value of this. 8888. Ask Leo. Howard's in Mission Viejo, California. Hi, Howard. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Thanks, Leo. I have Windows 7 and want your recommendation on the best program to record and then save to the computer the audio and video that I have right on my computer screen that I may be watching.
You want to capture, it's called screen capture.
Correct, yeah.
The screen, and the best is Camtasia, but it can be expensive.
That's okay.
it's what a lot of people use who do this kind of thing. Are you going to now? Well, here's my question: are you going to record yourself playing video games as people?
No.
What do you want to do with this?
Well, if I'm watching, for your program, you have a podcast, but for someone that I'm watching doesn't have a podcast.
You want to capture? I get what you're saying. You want to capture. You're watching video on the screen and you want to save it for later, even though they don't allow that necessarily.
Right.
We do that with our video. You can watch the stream, but you can also later get the video on YouTube or download it. And it's, we're not trying to hide that from anybody. Sometimes people who do, sporting, for instance, let's say you're watching the World Cup right now. They don't give you a way to download that. But what if you wanted to save it? There are really good commercial programs for this, a lot less expensive than Camtasia. Replay TV is a very, is it Replay? Nope, that's not the name. Oh, old age is a pain. It is from Applian, Applian. Let me just see if I can find the website, Applian.com. And the name of the program is, Replay. It wasn't as crazy as I thought. The Replay Capture Suite. Now, they actually have several different programs. And for specifically capturing video, you just need the Replay video capture. But they also, this stuff from Applian allows you to record music and radio and all sorts of stuff. But it's really great for going to, let's say, the World Cup and then capturing the video as you watch it so you can watch it later. Now, there are free programs that do this with, it's not quite so easy, VideoLAN Client, VLC, is the one that I always tell people about. You can get that from videoland.org.
Okay.
But you have to find the URL for the stream. It's not capturing your screen. It's the stream itself. You feed the stream to the VLC. You watch it on VLC, but you can also record as you're watching it. So that's a little bit more tricky. You have to figure out what the link is to that stream. Replay will just capture it automatically.
Yeah, I'd rather pay and go simple.
Yeah, and it's $30 or $40. It's not expensive.
Okay. And also, would that also be the best way to save like a YouTube video? Is there really a short way to? I see a lot of stuff online on how to save YouTube videos, but is there a really quick way just to do that one?
Yeah, TubeSock.
Okay.
TubeSock is a website that lets you go to TubeSock. Actually, it's stinkbot.com. Excuse me, but that's the name. and you can get TubeSock for Mac or Windows. There's a free trial. It will let you download videos from YouTube and save them. Understand, the reason that you can't do this sometimes is because the rights holders, I think they understand that if soon as you're putting something on the internet, it's pretty hard to prevent people from saving it. But the rights holders check a box that says, look, we're going to stream this, but we don't want to make it available for download. But as soon as something's playing on your screen, there's no way they can stop you. You could take a video camera and record it, or any number of things, since there's lots of software out there. TubeSock is just one. There are a great many ways to record YouTube, and our chat room's coming up with a number of them, like SaveDio.com, that's free. Screencast-O-Matic is free. KeepVid.com is free. You know what we're going to do? We are going to make the ultimate guide to saving YouTube video and put it on our website, techguylabs.com. That's all you really need, techguylabs.com. And if you search for Hour 3, Question 1 or 2, you should be able to find not only the audio and the video, which we make available freely, you don't have to record it, but also the answer and the links. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. As Addy Man and a few in the chat room have pointed out, recording YouTube videos is a violation of their terms of service. There, I've said it. I don't know really what's wrong with it. But it is technically you're just supposed to watch it on YouTube, not anywhere else. Dave in Riverside, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Dave.
Yes, sir. Love your show.
Thank you.
Just make sure if you're going to be jumping in the water, you have protection from Jaws.
I will wear some Jaws protective materiel. Are there sharks in Hawaii? I guess there are. There's sharks in every ocean of the world, aren't there?
I think they have a problem with tiger sharks down there.
Really? Nah, that's good enough.
Anyway, our great experiment with community-free Wi-Fi is coming to an end tomorrow.
Rats! Riverside was famous for doing this. They're going to stop it?
It ends effectively tomorrow.
And why? Do you know?
Well, they've had too many complaints that the service didn't work, but for a lot of people it did.
Well, that seems dumb. If it's working for some, what do you care?
I didn't particularly care. I got rid of my Verizon bill just because of the free service. But it's going to end. I'm going to end up going back to Verizon.
I guess AT&T, which originally set it up like 7 years ago, pulled out of it. And so the city has been keeping it going. Maybe the city decided it didn't want to continue to spend that kind of money. I have to tell you, though, that I agree, and I think it's a great thing in a community to have community Wi-Fi. It doesn't chase internet service providers out of business because you still want something in your home. But as you walk downtown or you're able to use it in the parks and so forth, internet everywhere is marvelous. Unfortunately, the people who really don't like it are the internet service providers. Their position is that municipalities, local and state governments should not be allowed to compete with them. I guess I understand that. If they did a better job, though, I wouldn't be. I would be a little more understanding. But a lot of these ISPs don't do such a good job. They overcharge for and underperform. And I think if communities want to offer Wi-Fi, they ought to be able to. Well, that's disappointing.
I don't blame them for trying.
Yeah.
It definitely set us apart from most of the communities around. Yeah. It was definitely a service to the people. Like I said, I was able to go off of Verizon for almost 2 years.
Yeah, see, well, maybe it did. See, it cost Verizon money, didn't it? So what happened, by the way, this was the first community Wi-Fi was in Philadelphia, and immediately Verizon sued. And then, more successfully than that, they went to state legislatures and got upwards of 30 states to outlaw it outright. Say,
wow.
It's illegal. Can't do it. And so I guess it's still legal in some states, and I really think the state legislators might want to reconsider that.
So. Well, they want to continue the service in small areas of the city, but they don't want to make it accessible to the entire community.
So what's the question? Are you looking for something to replace it? Or?
Yeah, I was trying to see if you knew of any applications where an actual city was able to put in something workable. As here, you have to be within 500 feet of the broadcast nodes to be able to receive
a signal. That's the real cost of it, is that Wi-Fi really isn't designed for mass deployment. It's designed for 100, 150 feet. And so in order for that to work, you have just like a cell service, you have to put individual stations everywhere so that everybody, people can receive it. And, it may be that it's expensive enough that that this is something that Riverside City fathers and mothers decided they didn't want to spend the money. I think it's more to the point that companies like Comcast are trying to get in this business, too. I don't know if you know this, but in most areas of the country, most heavily populated areas where Comcast offers cable service, when you get Comcast Internet with a Wi-Fi router, they turn on a guest account. And that guest account is available to anybody passing by who's also a Comcast customer. It's a big business for Comcast, and eventually they hope to make it, in effect, a form of wireless cell phone service. Because if you're a Comcast customer, you can you know once you log into this, anywhere you go that's near a Wi-Fi access point that Comcast provides, you can get online. And so naturally, they would prefer that cities like Riverside don't offer this for free. They want to charge for it. So I imagine Riverside is one of the communities that does have Comcast Wi-Fi, you know, community Wi-Fi. Well, it's not free, though. It's not open. You have to be a customer.
It's not Comcast. It's Charter down there.
Charter. Charter may be doing the same thing for all I know. You know, this is
probably
an interesting business. AT&T apparently does it as well. Anyway, I don't know of anything free. You know, you can go to a coffee shop. You can go to McDonald's. There's lots of places. If you buy a burger or a cup of coffee, you can get Wi-Fi. There are coffee shops that offer it just free. It's not expensive. You have to pay for the internet access. You have to put up a Wi-Fi access spot. I had really hoped that we'd have internet everywhere by now.
Well, I just hope to see a community application as opposed to something where you had to go to a coffee shop to get service.
I agree. I think New York City has offered public Wi-Fi in some parks. I seem to remember Washington Square Park in New York City has open free Wi-Fi. I'd like to see more of that. It isn't free, really, right? Taxpayers pay for it. But I think the benefit to a city is sufficient that it's worth it. And it's not very expensive. It really isn't. I'm disappointed to hear that Riverside's getting out of the business. Alan in San Diego, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, Alan.
Hey, Leo.
Welcome.
You and I go way, way back.
Well, it's nice to see you again.
To the Tech TV days when
you provided,
I believe, the Cisco cameras to various users.
You were part of the NetCam network?
Yes, I was.
Awesome.
And I was at the Palo Alto Senior Center helping out all of the seniors
in our
computer lab get to you online and ask their questions for computer problems.
That's awesome.
Okay, but here's my major question. I have an Apple iPhone 5C.
Yeah.
And I get tons of emails that I would like to not read, as well as the ones I want to read. But I was attempting to find a way to delete all of my emails at one time. I went online looking on YouTube and
Apple doesn't even give you an easy way to delete all your text messages. Forget emails.
My question is there any solution to just, you know, a couple of keystrokes of deleting all of my emails, both the ones I've read and the ones that I don't want to read, at one time? Yes or no? You're the guru, so you should know.
Well, if you want to delete everything, yes. You go in the usage, go in your settings on your iPhone, and in the general settings, there's a usage thing, and you can see how much space everything's using. Mail will be one of those applications, and you can clear it.
Really? How?
Oh, yeah. Well, just go in there, and you'll see. There's a button to release that space. If that doesn't get rid of everything, of course, deleting the account and restoring it will, but that's a pain. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I just discovered a new command on my phone. I go, okay, Nathan, play the Dixie Chicks Landslide, and it just happens. It's an amazing thing. Every phone should have a Nathan. Nathan Staten, our musical director. Awesome. He's fast. He's actually faster, I think, than Google was on that. Very quick. We're still looking, Alan. We've got an iPhone here. I thought going into the usage would help me delete it, but I can't. Now, Alan, there's one issue. Who do you get your email from?
Verizon.
So if you had a POP server, then deleting them locally would work. But if it's an IMAP server, it isn't stored locally. You're just getting a view into the IMAP mail. And even if you deleted it locally, it would just pop right back in.
That's right. That's exactly what happens.
Well, there's nothing they could do about it. The good news is it's not taking up much, shouldn't be taking up much space on your phone because it's stored on a server. It's not downloading it, maybe downloading it as a cache.
I see.
But it's not really storing it there. This is one really great feature of IMAP as opposed to POP mail. For years, when you got email from your internet service provider, it was POP mail. You remember it would go out, get the mail, it would fetch it, it would download it. And then, unless you told it otherwise, it would delete it from the server. So you had a copy, but it was a local copy. And that's because hard drive space was pricey, and the internet service provider didn't want to take the time of storing all your email. But around about 2006, Along comes Google saying, hey, guess what? We're going to store all your email forever. You get gigabytes of storage. You never have to delete your email, and that way you can search it. And that really opened people's eyes up to the idea that maybe you don't want to have your email downloaded. Maybe you just want to store it on a server and have access to it. IMAP, which has been around for longer than that, became a very popular way to store your email. Most servers now are IMAP, and that means you don't, the mail doesn't live on your phone. It lives on the server. If you don't want it, you can go to your IMAP server. You can go to your Verizon webmail and delete it there, and then it will stop showing up on your phone.
Okay.
So that's where you need to do it. You need to do it on the server, not on the phone. Because even if you do do it on the phone, as you've discovered, it's just going to go whoop, pop right back in. The good news is, and I don't know how much the iPhone caches, but it probably doesn't save that much of it. And it probably doesn't occupy that much space since it's already on the server. John, San Diego, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, John.
Hi, Leo. I have a friend who's using Outlook 2000, and Outlook was working fine until he moved to your area and had to switch to Comcast. And he's getting the message, could not find the server.
Yeah. Well, probably in the move, something he had to change settings. You've got to make sure that the settings are correct. Who provides the server for his email? Is it Comcast now?
Yes, Comcast.
Okay. So he's using Comcast's Comcastic email server.
Right. Well, let me just interject here that he's tried these settings in Outlook Express, and those settings work fine. But like I say, in Outlook,
that's probably Pop Mail, though, right? Outlook Express didn't do IMAP; it did Pop Mail.
Yeah, it's Pop.
So yeah, and is he trying to use Pop on his Outlook 2000?
Right, and it works. I know that it works in Outlook 2000 because that's what I use, and he was using it too when he was down here, and did not have Comcast, by the way, down here.
Yeah.
So Comcast said they don't support Outlook 2000, so he was thinking maybe he should try Outlook 2010. But I told him that I didn't think it would make any difference. You know, you put the same settings in there, and I would expect him to have the same problem.
You know, I am looking at a thread in the Comcast help section, getting Outlook 2000 to work with Comcast. So it may not be the easiest thing to do. Apparently, it's not completely easy. Under the servers tab, you want incoming.
Well, it was outgoing that he's having the problem.
Oh, it's SMTP. Oh, okay. So here's the key on that. Now you've fixed this all for me. So he can receive his mail, he just can't send it.
Well, no, I don't know that he can receive anything. He hasn't tested that. But
so here's the key. Outlook doesn't support the standard SMTP port 25. They don't want you to set up a spam server on your home system. So they block port 25. So to use Outlook with Comcast, you can't use the standard unsecured ports. You have to use the secure SSL ports. So that's a setting in the email. It should have said that, or should have been clear in the Comcast instructions. But you have to, I think it's port 465 or 993. You have to use the secure ports because port 25 is blocked on Comcast. So any email he tries to send will just won't go anywhere.
Well, he did have, I do remember seeing a web page that said something about port 995.
Yeah.
And there was a setting within Outlook 2000 that let him enter that.
Make sure he's doing it right, because you won't get any outbound. 995 is for secure POP import, and they want you to use 587 for outbound. Normally we use 25 and 110. So that's the point, is that you can't use the default ports because Comcast doesn't want you to use it. I'm looking at customer.comcast.com where they describe this. It's just you got to make sure SSL encryption is checked. You should use a special port 587 for outbound mail. And then they say recommended, and they say only if needed 485. So I'll tell you what, we'll put a link in the show notes to this specific Comcast page that tells you how to set up email with any client on Xfinity. And this really comes from the fact that most internet service providers, this is the case, they don't want to support the standard ports because they don't want you to put a outbound mail server on your computer at home and spam people. Or worse, have a bad guy get on your system and use your system for spam, which also happens. So we've got a number of people doing a great job in the chat room putting up links on how to get this to work. It will work. It is a blocked port. You need to use those special ports and special settings, not the standard ports and settings used by Outlook. And that, you know what? That's pretty much the case on every internet service provider these days. They all block that port. Libby in Claremont, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Libby. By the way, that information will be on our website, techguylabs.com. Hi, Libby.
Hello, Libby.
Earth to Libby. Claremont, wake up. Okay, I'm going to put Libby on hold if I can figure this out. So what do I do? I press hold and I tap that button, and now she's on hold. And you can just keep an eye on her. And if she comes back, would you let me know, Heather? Meanwhile, we'll go to Noah in Orange County. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. So I got a phone as a gift from my uncle.
That's nice.
He's a tech guy, and he went to Dubai for a conference thing, and he got it from there.
Ah.
And he brought it back here for me, and I broke it. And I can't find anywhere around here that fixes it, because the only place they sell it is China and the Arab Emirates.
What's the phone?
It's the X1 by X-Touch.
Wow, never heard of that one.
Yeah, it's a pretty good phone. It's like it's a new company. And
Souq, S-O-U-Q. So they do sell it now in the U.S. This is nice. It's 4.7 inches, Super AMOLED screen, dual SIM, which tells you it's designed not for the U.S. but for developing nations where they often use more than one SIM in a phone, which is weird. We're not used to that. Retina display, they say, well, that's an Apple trademark, so they probably should take that off their page. Quad-core chip. Yeah, this is a nice phone. Looks good. Where do you get it fixed? So did you crack the screen? Is that what happened?
It's not the screen that's cracked, because it's like a plastic screen, but there's like a layer behind it that's spidered.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be tricky because, as you know, if you have an iPhone or many Android phones, there are people all over town will fix those because they get the parts easily. I don't know where you'd go, but maybe the chat room does. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Wow, time flies when you're using port 25. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Last segment of the show today. I'll be going to Hawaii tomorrow. I'll be back in 2 weeks. Mr. Scott Wilkinson, my hero, will be filling in for me next week talking about home theater and all that. So we have Libby back. Should I go to Libby? All
we right. do indeed. She promises she'll be there.
No, that's okay. You know what? We keep you on hold so long, it's understandable. You might want to take a bathroom break once in a while. Libby in Claremont, California, just thank you for not taking the phone with you. Hi, Libby.
Hi, Leo. Have a great time in Hawaii.
Thank you. I'm so excited.
What island?
Maui.
Oh, fun.
Going to the Grand Wailea on Maui.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll be swimming. Apparently, they have a water park. They have the lazy river, and then they have a water elevator. So this is a super lazy river. So you don't even have to walk back. You just get on the elevator. It takes you back up. What can I do for you today?
We have some mini DVs from when our children were a little younger, before they had digital camcorders.
Yes.
And I hired a company to transform them into DVDs, but I would also like to make digital copies of the data on an external hard drive. The problem is I've done all this research in AVI, MPEG-4.
No, it's easy. I'm going to simplify this all for you. Okay. So I too have, we went through these format wars and so forth, yes. And video cameras had all these different ways of recording. I still have some Hi8 video remember the VHS recorders?
Yes.
Mini DV was good because it was digital. So the fact that you found somebody with a mini DV playback device is great because the quality is going to be preserved because it's digital on the tape. It'll go right to digital. They made DVDs because that's what most people want. It's easy. If they had as an option put it on a hard drive, I would have chosen that because unfortunately the problem with DVDs is for DVDs they have to be recorded in a format called MPEG-2. Which is okay. It's DVD quality. That's probably good enough. But it could be better. Nevertheless, it's on. It is on the disc digital, and you don't have to do anything particular to it. What you want to do is rip the disc. That is, take the data off the disc and put it on your hard drive. And I would just leave it in the format it's in, because anything you do to change that is going to degrade it.
Oh, okay.
Now, if you don't have a DVD playing program on your computer, then you may not be able to play it back. So VLC, VideoLAN client, will play it back for free, VLC,
okay,
from VideoLAN.org. The program I'd use to rip it is called Handbrake. It's also free.
Handbrake.
Okay. Both of these programs, for reasons I don't understand, are from France. They have a different, I don't know why, but there's okay. There must be a very big movement in France to rip DVDs and play them back. So handbrake.fr, B-R-A-K-E, like a handbrake in a car, .fr, and then videoland.org. If you wish to convert them to a format that you don't need a DVD player to play back, you can do that within Handbrake. They have settings for all kinds of devices. So you can actually, what I would suggest is just rip it. Don't re-encode it. But okay, when you want to put it on an iPad, for instance, run it through Handbrake again and make a separate copy that's iPad specific. What you want to do is keep the highest quality original you can on the hard drive.
Yes. Plus, will this give us the ability in the future, if we wanted to edit it, to add music,
absolutely,
titles?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Any video editing program can ingest the MPEG-2 format.
Okay, so just rip, don't change.
Rip, don't re-encode.
Because re-encode.
When you re-encode, it's just like re-squeezing. It's gonna degrade it a little bit.
Okay.
So keep the MPEG-2 version on the drive. Call it your master. You may never even use it, but just call it your master. It's the same exact quality as on the DVD, which is probably very close to the original mini DV quality.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you. Do you have one more question for...
Sure, more time for you, anything.
Oh, you are so awesome. I have a Samsung Galaxy S3 with Verizon, and just where we live, we have absolutely miserable service out of our home, and one of my friends was saying there's a way to make voice over internet protocol calls from the Samsung using your home internet service provider.
But first thing I would do is go to Verizon and say, I have terrible service in my home. I'm going to discontinue you until you solve that. And they'll, if you're lucky, give you something called a femtocell. A femtocell is a home cell phone base station. It's awesome. You plug it into your internet, and all of a sudden you're getting 5 bars in the house.
Ah.
And it is doing what you just described, in fact. It's using the internet to transmit the calls over the network. Many times, every cell phone company offers these. Sometimes AT&T calls them a micro cell. Sometimes you have to pay for it. And you can always buy it, but what I would like to do is if you threaten them saying, oh, you know, I just love Verizon, you're wonderful, but boy, I just cannot get any reception in the home, and that's a deal breaker. And then they'll say, oh, no, wait, don't leave. We'll just give you this femtocell.
Yeah, they actually have told us that their advice for their poor service was for us to go spend more money on exactly what you described, which I'm not willing to do.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not guaranteeing this will work. Lately, these guys are so arrogant and so big that they just go, well, I'm sorry to hear that. Good luck with the other guy. They don't make any attempt to retain you, but it used to be, in the good old days, they had these people called customer retention experts who would go the extra mile to keep you as a customer. Because if you think about it, how many thousands of dollars a year do you give Verizon?
Yeah, a lot.
A lot.
Quite a bit.
So to give you a $200 femtocell to keep you as a customer seems to me a good idea.
Yeah.
So you say, hey, we have a family plan. We give, you know, we spend thousands of dollars with you every year. But we're going to have to move to AT&T because we're just not getting home coverage. And then perfect, see what they do.
Great.
All right.
All right. Thanks a million.
Thanks, Libby. Appreciate it. F-E-M-T-O. Like I said, some companies call them microcells. It's the same thing. It just plugs into your internet. And it's a cell phone base station in your house, so you get 5 bars. It's kind of cool. I'm hoping I have enough time to get one more call in here. Adam, Augusta, Georgia. Hi, Adam.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Welcome.
Yeah, I guess I have sort of a complicated question here. I'm a guitarist, and I was curious. I have a Rocksmith cable that goes from quarter inch to USB. And I was wondering if somehow I could use the Microsoft Surface RT to plug that in and use the guitarist, or is there a program I could download or buy that has a use the guitar from the USB input as a synthesizer?
That's a good question. I don't know. The Rocksmith, is it the cable takes, you plug it into your guitar, it's got a phono jack in your guitar, right? And it turns it into USB.
Yes.
So basically it's taking the unbalanced output of a guitar you'd normally put in an amplifier, turning it into digits, into bits that you can use on a computer. Of course, on a regular PC, there are lots of solutions that will take this input. The problem is Windows RT. That's the ARM-based solution. You'd have to find something in the Metro store. They used to call it Metro. I guess they call it, I don't know what they call it, modern UI. Does anybody know offhand if there is a synthesizer, USB input synthesizer program? Because that's cool. I mean, you can do it on an iPad. No problem. There's so much music software on the iPad. But Windows RT, it seems like software is pretty scant. I know you can do it on the iPad. I don't know what you can do on Windows RT, and nobody in the chat room seems to be jumping up saying, try this.
Yeah, because I've looked online, and mostly I haven't seen a solution online. Mostly people use the Rocksmith table for recording purposes.
Right. I don't know. I'll tell you what. If we find it, we'll put it in the show notes at techguylabs.com. Thanks for the call. Thanks for listening. Leo Laporte.
The Tech Guy.
Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. I'm Leo Laporte. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, the Tech Guy is just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows now on the Twit Netcast Network, and you'll find them all at twit.tv. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on MacBreak Weekly, iPad on iPad Today. You get your daily dose of tech news from Tech News Today and our weekly roundtable show, This Week in Tech. It's all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next time with another great Tech Guy podcast. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.